Accession number 28528, Reel 17.
Mr. Tony Pawson, Reel 16.
As often as not, those who had done something heroic were the last ones to talk about it. There were two good examples of that in the personnel department of Reed Paper Group, of which John McGavin is the first. When asked to help sort his papers, I was glad to come across an article in the Gold Coast papers of the day, newspapers of the day, telling how he won his MC. It is very well worth recording, not just for him, but because Churchill's famous quote, "Before Alamein we never won a victory, after it we never had a defeat," denigrates earlier achievements. That clever soundbite is unfairly dismissive of several notable victories against overwhelming odds, which led to the destruction of the whole Italian army in the desert and the undermining for good of their fighting morale, as they had in fact been far more numerous and with much better supply of arms and tanks and planes. It included also two quite remarkable victories. There was the 150-mile or so dash to Biedefom, completed in just 50 hours over near impossible areas of desert. To arrive there 1 hour before the vanguard of the retreating remnants of the Italian army. Without rest, they took on troops who outnumbered them 5-1 in men, tanks, and guns, and who for once fought with desperate courage and aggression, yet had to surrender in the end. There was also the remarkable defence of Tobruk and its relief by the successful Crusader offensive. That is at least on a par, or at least in the same league as the much-lauded American defence of Bastogne, which lasted only a week or so before Patton broke through to them, compared to many months of greater odds at Tobruk, and relentless day and night bombing from clear skies. At Bastogne, when the clouds cleared, it was the attacking Germans who were relentlessly bombed, but at Tobruk the ceased. On the outbreak of war, John McGavin had left his civilian occupation and joined the Gold Coast Regiment. The Western Desert fighting was the more memorable, but his Abyssinian campaign was equally successful against equally adverse odds in troop numbers and in equipment. This is how he was involved. Towards the end of the Abyssinian campaign, John was prominent in the fierce three-day battle which finally dislodged the Italians from their stronghold among the hills, forests, and ravines of Uadara. He featured again as their retreating army made a stand at Blackshirt Ridge. This was, in fact, the first time the Blackshirts had been in battle, and their machine guns and artillery stopped the advance of the leading Gold Coast Company. From behind the ridge, groups of 60 Blackshirts on each flank then came charging in with fixed bayonets. They were so bunched together that Bren gun fire drove them off with heavy casualties. Despite the rutted roads blocked by mines, felled trees, and abandoned vehicles, John then led a relentless pursuit in pouring rain, pressing on for 3 days without rest. The Gold Coast Standard, under the heading "Enemy Crumbles After Valiant Fighting," thus described the action which won him his VC. Success was at hand. At 9:30 on the morning of 20th May 1941, the leading pursuit company, led by a tall, fair-haired giant of a man, Captain John McGavin, and with a section of armoured cars, ran into two battalions of infantry and a battery of guns and captured the lot. The surrender also had an amusing side. The Italian brigadier was very much on his dignity, at first refusing to surrender to anyone so young and so junior. with his cheery men with fixed bayonets surrounding the brigadier, John was quick-witted enough to say, "My colonel is coming up just behind and will have expected you to surrender before he arrives." That the brigadier and his 1,700 men promptly did. Despite appalling weather and blocked roads, the company pressed on to Hula, the final objective. That relentless pursuit led to the capture of successive groups of demoralized retreaters, one group of which comprised 50 officers and 500 men. Reduced to two platoons, as one had to be left to deal with the prisoners, McGavin never paused. All the way up the long straight road to Hula, at the top of a 1,000 feet high hill, the Italians could see how small was his force compared to theirs, which was some 20 times stronger, with plentiful machine guns and artillery. Undaunted, McGavin and his two platoons surged into the village, and again there was a pantomime as the commanding officer refused to surrender to such a junior officer and so small a force. McGavin gave him 10 minutes to make up his mind or to be attacked. 5 minutes was enough for the commander and 1,300 men, many of them native auxiliaries, to surrender. The medal citation emphasized the way McGavin had kept going in driving rain without rest to hustle the retreating enemy into surrender before they could pull themselves together and make a stand. There were harder tasks ahead for the Gold Coast Regiment, but John's successful tackling of them all is evident enough as he ended the war as major and their second in command. That was no surprise to me when I found that another of the men I was working with had been similarly and probably even rather more successful, adventurous and courageous. The other member of the department, Roger Hill, RN, with his charismatic personality, piratical looks and adventurous nature, was never at ease with the boring routine of running our large industrial site services, including catering, fire and security. But we certainly knew little anything of his wartime exploits as a destroyer captain, one of which was genuinely heroic and might well have earned him more than his DSC and DSO. Two convoys were linked for him. First, there was the Admiralty's most shameful episode of the war, then one of the Navy's most important achievements, in the success of which he was outstanding. First, he was captain of a destroyer protecting convoy PQ-17 to Russia. Believing wrongly that the battleship Tirpitz was about to attack the convoy, the Admiralty ordered the outgun protective screen of warships to scatter fast. That left the merchantmen to their fate as hordes of bombers and submarines obliterated most of the convoy, with very few ships making it to port at Archangel. In the icy Arctic Sea, survival was a matter of minutes rather than hours, and the Merchant Navy found it hard to forgive the abandonment of their ships. In summer 1943, besieged Malta was on the verge of surrender through shortage of food and supplies of every kind. It had a key role in its submarines and aircraft, intercepting much of the supplies coming to the Africa Corps as Rommel prepared to attack in the Alamein area and drive for Cairo. But to reach Malta, the convoy of 13 large fast merchantmen and a vital tanker in its huge protective screen had to face incessant bombing from nearby bases and relentless attack by submarines and small motor torpedo boats, almost invisible in the dark, and the threat of the Italian Navy for once coming out to join the fighting. Before he sailed, Roger told his crew that whatever orders he got, his destroyer would never abandon the merchantman while any was afloat. But by the time they got reasonably close to Malta, only four merchant ships remained and the much battered tanker Ohio, an American ship crewed by the British. Each merchant ship had exactly the same cargo of crucial supplies for Malta, with the aircraft fuel stacked in cases on the decks, making them all floating bonfires. The last to go had been the Weimarama, which blew up, scattering blazing fuel into the sea all around. Into this inferno, Roger sailed his ship and rescued nearly 100 badly injured men. As a fellow destroyer captain commented, he either deserved the VC or a court-martial for hazarding his ship. For Roger, this was atonement for PQ-17. When two Italian torpedo planes then attacked the Ledbury, he ordered the Beaufort's gunners to hold their fire until certain of hitting them. This they did, sending both plunging into the sea, but only after they got close enough to release torpedoes, at least one of which missed by a few feet. Seeing clouds of black smoke nearby, Hill then made for it and found the tanker Ohio dead in the water, with a fire being put out for a second time. It had been hit by torpedo and bomb, and two shot-down planes had crashed on its deck. With the aid of two other destroyers and Rogers, the Ohio, against all odds and under incessant attack, was towed to the grand harbour of Valletta at agonisingly slow pace, with a destroyer lashed to each side and with Rogers Ledbury steering. The survival of that tanker was absolutely crucial to Malta, particularly for petrol and so on, for aircraft and submarines and all the rest. For the first few miles, protective Spitfires came out from Malta. For the final few miles, protective Spitfires came out from Malta to give effective cover. Earlier, the crew had been told to abandon ship and been picked up by the destroyers. Some young merchant gunners had, however, returned to keep the Ohio's anti-aircraft guns firing. In a break from the attacks, they had raided the food lockers, with this well-stocked American ship also having a special one for Christmas when it came. The German and Italian pilots must indeed have wondered at the mad British when they found themselves fired on by gunners wearing coloured Christmas cracker hats. By the time the Ohio reached harbour, it was barely afloat, and the oil had to be pumped out at speed before it sank. Roger was overwhelmed by the reception at Malta, with every vantage point lined with cheering crowds. His comment was, "This is the most marvellous moment of my life. I was very humbled by these people cheering us. They had been bombed day and night for months with up to 100 Axis planes at a time, making this the most bombed place on earth. Yet we had only been fighting our way to them for 3 days or so." But for Roger and all the surviving crews of this pedestal convoy, it had been some 3 days. The survival and restocking of Malta deprived Rommel of many of the tanks and much of the needed petrol, which would otherwise have made it harder for Montgomery to win the defensive battle of Alam Halfa, followed by the Alamein defeat of the Afrika Korps, which started them on their 2,000-mile retreat and ultimate surrender in Tunisia. Monty was quick to repay Malta's help in cutting off Rommel's supplies by skillful use of their bombers and submarine. He raced ahead to capture the Martuba airfields just in time for them to give total fighter cover support as the next convoy from Alexandra approached Bomb Alley and all four merchantmen came through unscathed. The importance of this final relief was underlined by two comments. When the news came through, CIGS General Alan Brooke wrote in his diary, "Thank God," while Field Marshal Kesselring commented sourly, "Malta continues to cast its baleful shadow over all our operations." For Roger, the memory was so indelible that a recent ceremony has asked there was the scattering of his ashes in the Grand Harbour as a centrepiece of the day. Our personnel department was at least represented there by my long-time and exceptionally efficient Reed Secretary Marguerite and her husband John Maynard. Marguerite having written all my 14 books. Roger did not long survive in a job which gave no scope for his adventurous spirit. While he was with Reed, none of us knew anything of this, only becoming aware when a video about Pedestal was produced. This was at the inspiration of an Irish lady, Noreen Malloy, who was fascinated by accounts of Pedestal rather than by any of our own media, who tend to be more interested in past defeats or scandals. This was also seen by the catering manager of Roger's day at Reed, Sid Hall, who often appeared at Daggers Drawn with him. He then told us that, by coincidence, he had been on one of the few surviving ships of PQ-17, and for him all naval officers were beyond contempt until he heard of Roger's atonement and wished he had known earlier. Another one from whom I easily found out his most memorable war experiences was my brother-in-law, John Bassett. He had been at Winchester with me, and indeed in the cricket 11 with me, when he was a useful leg spin bowler. Outside Winchester, as the M3 motorway curves round Winchester, it passes beneath a steep, wide cutting across which is so-called Spitfire Bridge. John Maynard, who is an aviation historian and regular contributor to Aeroplane magazine, tells me it was a Mustang, not a Spitfire, which flew under it. But whichever it was, my brother-in-law can empathise with it, as he flew both aircraft and had great admiration for both. As regards the Mustang, that was not the case when he flew one with its original American Allison engine. As he comments, the Mustang 1 was underpowered with the original Allison engine. It also had one other glaring defect. It lacked automatic boost control. That meant you had to use the throttle manually to increase boost as you climbed. That was necessary in order to counteract the thinner air at altitude. The pilot could not ignore this, as the increasing loss of power was soon obvious. The converse was also true. Diving down into thicker air meant you had to pull back on the throttle or risk blowing a few cylinder heads. Sometimes people found that out for real when they forgot to throttle back. Once the Mustang became a real joint American-British plane with a Rolls-Royce engine and long-range fuel tanks added, it was a real war winner. When these planes appeared over Berlin escorting the Lancaster bombers, so effectively that the German fighters rarely appeared, the Germans could see and hear that the war was virtually over. John flew in some of these sorties and in a most unusual escort job after the war. His Mustangs were assigned to escort Churchill to a meeting in Berlin with the Russians. All the pilots were instructed to try and be on the friendliest terms with the Russian, and it was suggested that a gift of a watch or a clock would be well received, as indeed John's was. The next gift, however, was an alarm clock, and the donor, trying to let the Russians know what it was, let off the alarm. That did indeed alarm the Russians, and they were instantly surrounded by guards with machine pistols pointed. Their interpreter had to work hard to restore good relations, but it all ended in laughter and toasting. For John, the only fault with the Spitfire was its relatively small fuel load and therefore limited range. That gave him problems in his many dogfights in it over Europe, for which he was eventually mentioned in dispatches. On one occasion, he realised he had no chance of making it back to a main airfield, but recalled there was an emergency airstrip on the edge of the coast at All it consisted of was a runway with a hut at the end. As he came in to land, a motorcyclist suddenly appeared at speed and rode beside him. It was a doctor checking whether he was all right, as indeed he was. He was much impressed by this simple but effective emergency arrangement, which had often brought welcome relief to wounded pilots or those with damaged aircraft or short of fuel. While flying Spitfires, he was with a wing of two Polish and one Commonwealth squadron commanded by a Pole, Wing Commander Zumba. For him, the Poles were the finest group of people he had ever met. On the ground, they were great companions. In the air, their hatred of the Germans made them unrivaled fighters, with his experienced squadron accepting that the Poles were the better, except in communicating in the air. While flying to battle, their communication drill was perfect, and they talked as quietly as if they had a mouthful of razor blades. Once German planes were sighted, it became an incomprehensible, excited babble. But despite the fury aroused by the sight of a German plane and their readiness to take any risk to make a kill, it never adversely affected their flying skills. On one occasion, a Polish squadron flying over Belgium had what was probably a unique victory. They spotted a squadron of fighters coming up from a German airfield and destroyed every single one of them in the air or on the ground. While with Mustangs, John had a number of unusual missions to fly. The Germans had some planes with heavy electrical degaussing equipment underneath to explode mines we were laying in the Baltic to restrict German shipping there. These were slow lumbering planes and were easy to shoot down if surprised, but if warning was given, they immediately flew back to base. So John and the others had to fly there from England at near wave top level to escape detection. So monotonous was flying like this over the sea that it was easy to lose concentration and plunge in. The Mustang had a bulbous addition below its belly with a separate vent which drew in air, some of which passed up through a small pipe to cool the cockpit if required by the pilot. On several occasions when this mesmeric flying made pilots drowsy, their wake-up call just in time was a jet of sea spray taken by this vent as they flew low over the wave tops. One of John's happiest periods was when based at Worthy Down Aerodrome just outside Winchester. His route home took him back over his parents' house, where Hilary and I now live, about a mile or two outside the city. John would circle the house until his mother laid a white sheet in the garden, as message understood. She would then use some of her limited petrol ration saved to such occasions and drive over to meet him at the gate. Another cricketer who played with me in our 1940 team was Philip Whitcomb, who was such a fine cricketer that he later played for both Oxford and Middlesex, and is one of the few who've removed Don Bradman for less than 10 runs when playing for Middlesex. While still at Winchester in 1941, Philip had passed a stiff army exam which led to a commission in the Royal Artillery by an obtuse at Catterick. In the D-Day invasion, he landed from an LST on the beaches at Arromanche, serving in the 15th Scottish Division, which was part of the build-up after D-Day. He continued to serve with them until wintering in Holland. There he answered a call for volunteers for 6th Airborne Division. He stayed with them from the Rhine crossing until meeting up with the Russians near Wismar on the Baltic, just before VE Day. Having endured a heavy physical training course and other preparations in learning to parachute, he was not too pleased to be told that in fact he was barred from jumping because his height was too great to fit him in easily. He was told he could appeal and ask for permission from his brigadier. His attempt to do so was a non-starter, as the brigadier was off on a fishing holiday in Ireland. Spared participation in the war against Japan by the dropping of atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he spent a year with 6th Airborne Division in Palestine, where surprisingly he managed to play a full season of cricket, mostly on matting. Air Marshal Sir Brian Baker, a keen cricketer, was at the time commanding the RAF in the Middle East and organised several matches in Egypt and in Palestine against combined services sides. Like my brother Philip, Whitcomb played his part in demonstrating the superior ability of our artillery to concentrate fire both in set-piece attacks and opportunity to end on opportunity targets. As he commented to me, the Germans had an excellent gun in the powerful 88mm, which was fired mainly over open sights. In my experience, however, there was an almost complete absence of counter-battery fire on our gun positions. By contrast, our communication systems were so well developed that we could quickly get large numbers of field guns firing on target simply by map reference. When our gun positions had been surveyed in, these could be exceptionally accurate. For planned attacks, the fire of more than 100 field and medium guns could be synchronized to fire a barrage at short notice on a target or a vital position, or target a vital position. This was something in which we really did outmatch the Germans. Another fellow cricketer with a fine record was not a Winchester team colleague, but a Kent one. Medium pacer Eddie Crush, his cap number 116, having received his soon after me. He was in fact a much more accurate bowler than the naming of his Dover house facetiously as half volley implies. He is also older than me, so Eddie is the oldest surviving cap, while I am the earliest surviving one, since it was cap number 111 that I was given. It was the county's much appreciated practice of an annual invitation to an old cap's get-together at Canterbury, which only recently alerted me to his wartime exploits. Lifelong friend though he has been, on the attendance list he was down, to my surprise, as Eddie Crush MC, so of course I wheedled a copy of his citation out of him. The citation for Lieutenant Edmund Crush reads, "Preparatory to the Libby attack on 8th July 1944, it was necessary to clear a damaged vehicle from the single road between our own and enemy positions. Lieutenant Crush was sent forward in a half-track to perform this task. Despite enemy mortar and artillery fire evoked by the noise of the operation, Lieutenant Crush, with great coolness and determination, persisted in his task and dragged the wreck a quarter of a mile to our own forward defence lines. At HR, he led a routine clearance team down the same road. Much of the enemy's defensive fire was centred on this single road approach. Both Lieutenant Crush's vehicles, a carrier and a half track, were put out of action by mortar fire, and he himself received several splinter wounds in the leg. Despite his injuries, an obvious fact of his operation lying in an enemy defensive fire task zone, Lieutenant Crush straightway led the party forward on foot and successfully removed mines and booby traps. As a result of his courage and determined leadership, anti-tank guns and a troop of an anti-tank regiment Royal Artillery were able to get up to the objective for consolidation at a very early stage of the battle. Arriving on the objective immediately behind the leading infantry, he set out at once to find and clear routes through the devastation for tanks and wheels, and continued working with great determination throughout a period of 2 hours, marked by continual and heavy enemy mortar and artillery fire. On the following day, Lieutenant Crush, with his platoon and four bulldozers, followed the infantry into the devastated area of Caen, and despite continual mortaring and the knowledge that the area had not been cleared of snipers, he directed with great energy the task of opening a route to the port area.